Highland Elementary today, school began on time, but not as usual.
Back in 1989, long before Parkland or Sandy Hook or even Columbine, there was Cleveland Elementary School in Stockton, California.
26-year-old Patrick Edward Purdy attended Cleveland Elementary School from kindergarten to third grade. But there is still no answer to the biggest question of all. Why Purdy walked onto the playground at lunchtime and mowed down 35 children and a teacher with automatic weapons before killing himself.
That's a newscast from 1989 when a gunman killed 5 school children and wounded 32 before killing himself. It happened nearly 30 years ago, but that script, when you hear it today, sounds familiar. And people then could have had no idea how many times their nightmare would be played again and again.
The nation was watching as students and teachers struggled to make sense out of what happened here.
I don't know that there's any precedent for this anywhere in public school history.
Even then, 3 decades ago, it was high school students trying to hold the NRA accountable.
Mr. Blackman, you said that the average American citizen is usually the one that's hurt by handgun or gun laws. Now, what he shot these people with was an AK-47, which is a military assault rifle made by Russians to kill people, not for hunting, not to protect yourself at home, but to kill. And I want to know why the NRA feels that these weapons should be on the streets. People should be using these weapons, which are also used in drive-by shootings in LA, which kill a number of people every day and every year throughout the state of California.
First of all, drive-by shootings can involve any type of firearm. That's the thing. If you let violent criminals on the streets, you're going to have violent acts.
That exchange sounds a lot like what we're hearing today after the Parkland shooting in Florida. But there was one major difference back in 1989. The massacre at Cleveland Elementary School in Stockton, California, spurred Congress to action.
And it just really caught my attention. And I got my staff to start looking into it, what these weapons were. I was just overwhelmed by these things, what they, in the old days, they called machine guns.
That's Senator Dennis DeConcini, a former Democratic U.S. Senator from Arizona. And his Senate colleagues took notice, too.
We're holding a hearing today on the question of what we do about assault weapons. We had a very dramatic illustration just recently in Stockton, California, where 5 innocent children who happen to be Asian Americans were killed by an assault weapon.
Today, a look behind the scenes at the political moment that gave rise to the 1994 assault weapons ban. I'm Todd Zwillick, and this is The Takeaway. It's been nearly a quarter century since Congress last passed significant gun control legislation. In 1994, President Bill Clinton signed into law the Public Safety and Recreational Firearms Use Protection Act, most commonly remembered for one provision tucked inside the assault weapons ban. Patrick Griffin was assistant for legislative affairs to President Clinton at the time.
The president was speaking to a Democratic Senate conference out in Southern Maryland someplace, where Senator Feinstein was in the audience and asked the president, what's the status of this issue? And I thought it was a little odd, since the legislation was sitting in her committee, of which she was the chairwoman. And the president kind of turned to me in the meeting and said, where are we? And I simply said it was in the chairwoman's committee. After that meeting, we were going back in Marine One, flying back to D.C., and the president said, you know, why aren't we kind of driving this issue? And I said, well, I hadn't gotten direct instructions to do that, but I can see your face and the tone of your voice that this is a priority.
Patrick Griffin knew that it wouldn't be easy whipping support for an assault weapons ban in Congress, but he set out to devise a plan with the help of Leon Panetta, who at the time was President Clinton's chief of staff.
The plan for doing it was to have it attached to a crime bill, which the president was aggressively promoting, and it was a somewhat controversial bill in and of itself.
The crime bill was hugely important for Clinton. Democrats suffered a reputation for being soft on crime, and this bill could help change that. But there was a lot not to like about the crime bill for Democrats, like, for instance, 28 new death penalty provisions. Bill Clinton hoped that the assault weapons ban would lure those Democrats to support the bill without jeopardizing the support of too many Republicans who prioritize the Second Amendment, and also the support of the NRA and its enormous lobbying power. Dennis DeConcini, the senator from Arizona, had a good record with the NRA. At one point, he was even named the NRA's Legislator of the Month. He remembers trying to convince the organization to get on board with an assault weapons ban.
When I wanted to try to get the NRA to support this, I had Mr. LaPierre, who's still there, and a guy named Jim Baker, who was their legislative assistant director at the time, and I had him up to the office, and I told him what I was going to do, and I might have given him a rough draft, I can't remember, but I told him it was going to outlaw nine automatic weapons and some other weapons that had automatic firing capabilities. And I said, you know, you guys should get behind this, and maybe we can compromise and work something out. And they were very, very adamant that there could be no compromise here. They were sorry. And I kept talking to them. And one of them, I can't remember which one, told me, well, you know, Senator, said, when we went along with the plastic gun restriction and passed that bill, our membership went down, meaning there was hardcore NRA members that felt they should not have given in even on that issue. And that's what they told me is one of the reasons, one, that they could not support my legislation.
Meanwhile, at the White House, Legislative Affairs Director Patrick Griffin was having his own trouble getting support for the bill, even among the Democratic leadership.
The leadership then asked to meet with the president in the Oval Office, and I remember it also vividly. It was Speaker Foley, Majority Leader Gephardt, and Whip Bonnier came into the Oval Office, and the president and the vice president, Gore, was there, and myself and Chief of Staff Panetta and maybe one or two other staffers. And basically they said that if you insist on including the assault weapon ban in this piece of legislation, we will not help you in any way pass this bill. What it resulted in was that Leon Panetta and I had to rely on our own what we call the whip operation, seeing if we can get the votes one by one to pass this crime bill that would include the assault weapon ban. The Democratic leadership gave us a room to work in, but that was about it.
But Griffin and Panetta weren't quite alone. There were some loud voices in the Senate pushing this legislation, like longtime gun control advocate Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein from California.
Anybody who's reasonable in the House, at least as far as I can see, has got to vote for this legislation because these weapons are doing just terrible things in schoolyards, in banks, in workplaces, all across this nation. And I think it's creating a level of anxiety and fear that we can well do without.
When the day of the vote arrived in the House, Patrick Griffin watched nervously from the chamber.
So I was anxious. I really didn't want to be up in the House chamber.
The question is on the passage of the bill.
There was a major vote, which would have been to strike this provision out of the bill. And it prevailed by one vote.
So many in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Opinion of the chair, the ayes have it.
So that meant it was in the bill and it was going to go to the Senate. You know, I was just torn. I mean, but I was up there and everybody's cheering and all I had was a knot in my stomach about it. They were not happy that this passed.
Patrick Griffin, again, from Bill Clinton's White House, recalling a night not long after the House vote in a meeting at the offices of Democratic Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell, along with Tom Foley, the Democratic Speaker of the House.
Speaker Foley had this big kind of down dog face on, and he says this is going to be problematic. And then this big bolt of lightning and thunder struck. We all kind of shook, but took it as a very ominous sign.
Democrats were still on edge about their re-elections, even taking signs from the storm outside the Capitol. The Senate eventually passed a different version of the bill than the one the House had agreed to. And during negotiations, desperate to pass that assault weapons ban, a 10-year sunset clause was added. In other words, an expiration date. The ban would end after 10 years unless Congress reinstated it.
It might have felt like a concession to the anti-assault weapon folks, but believe me, it gave them very little to no comfort. That vote was going to have immediate impact, and did, on their careers. And the fact that there was a sunset provision was really meaningless in the context of what those folks were facing in that election in the following November.
The 10-year limit did its job, and on September 13th, 1994, President Bill Clinton signed the Public Safety and Recreational Firearms Use Protection Act.
Today, the will of the American people has triumphed over a generation of division and paralysis. We've won a chance to work together. So in that spirit, let us rededicate ourselves today to making this law become the life of our country.
So what exactly did the assault weapons ban accomplish? For 10 years, from 1994 to 2004, it promised to ban semi-automatic assault weapons manufactured after the bill's passing. But any assault rifle that you owned prior to the bill passing was okay and still legal. It could even be resold. The law also banned large, high-capacity magazines holding more than 10 rounds. A Democratic victory, but a limited and short-lived one.
CNN is reporting tonight that, quote, very likely, the Republicans will take control of the United States House of Representatives with up to 50 seats.
Turns out Patrick Griffin and Democrats were right to worry. Newt Gingrich and the Republican Revolution had arrived.
We lost 54, 55 House seats in that election in 94 that turned, and many, if not most, were from rural South and Midwest states or districts that were anti-gun control. And in most cases, if not all cases, the reason that was given for their loss was the assault weapon ban.
So after that loss, was the assault weapons ban worth it? And beyond just the politics, did it actually work? The assault weapons ban was law for 10 years, 1994 to 2004. Did it save lives? Did it help prevent violent crime and mass shootings? Professor Daniel Webster is the director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Professor, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you.
Professor, you've written that we need to be realistic about the ability of an assault weapons ban to curb violence. What did you mean?
We have a very high rate of gun violence in the United States. The vast majority of that violence, however, does not look like the mass shootings that, you know, we spend a lot of time, for understandable reasons, concerning ourselves with. When you think about the safety of our children going to schools, those events stick in our mind. And quite commonly, not always, of course, but commonly, the high casualty count mass shootings, assault weapons are typically involved. But most violence, of course, in the United States is committed with handguns.
Well, let's talk about the assault weapons ban between 94 and 2004. What do we know about those years in terms of what happened to violent crime in general, mass shooting specifically, and the types of crimes that assault weapons are part of?
Sure. So criminologist Christopher Cooper, now at George Mason University, led a very extensive study looking at the assault weapon ban and its effects. He found that there, first of all, just before the ban, there was a huge spike in sales for such guns. And he also found that there were leakage points, if you will, a lot of copycat models that were introduced. What he found, however, in looking at overall crime rates and violence committed with firearms, particularly homicides, he found no measurable effect of the assault weapon ban. Most importantly, I think, again, when we think about assault weapons, we think about mass shootings. Dr. Cooper did not examine the effect of the ban on mass shootings, or if you think specifically, how might an assault weapon facilitate casualties? Really, it has to do with how many people are shot. So that outcome was not studied in Dr. Koper's research. If you look at the data of what's happened after the ban has expired, assault weapons have become far more common as far as what people own. And most dramatically, we see the number, average number of victims shot in mass shootings has gone up quite significantly post-ban.
So, Dr. Webster, America is talking about an assault weapons ban once again. It's easy to see why. Americans are watching AR-15s and similar weapons being used repeatedly in these high-profile crimes. What do Americans need to know about how effective a new ban might be, or how that ban might have to be designed to help prevent the kinds of shootings that we're seeing on our televisions?
Well, probably the most important thing is ammunition capacity. So the large capacity magazine ban is really particularly key here. I think the other important takeaway is that you want to design your ban in a manner that it's not easy to make copycat models with very modest differences in the weapons. I think another thing that could be considered, but I understand politically is probably not feasible, is what we did with machine guns or fully automatic guns, where there is full registry of such weapons. So, I mean, if I'm designing the most effective type of restriction, I would probably include that. But I don't expect that will happen simply because of political constraints.
Yeah, you mentioned those political constraints in this country, and they're significant. And look, when we look at the reality of a new ban in this country, Dr. Webster, even if one were to come into effect, lots of people, including Senator Marco Rubio just weeks ago, have pointed out that there are 300 million guns already in this country. He said he would be willing to entertain a ban if he thought that one could be effective, but with so many guns already on the market, an assault weapons ban might make people feel like they've done something without having much of a discernible effect on safety.
Well, you certainly have to concern yourself with the guns that are already available right now. Again, I think that, look, there are a lot of weapons available. The question really is, are those weapons easily available to someone who wants to get them? I think anytime you single out one particular gun policy, you can find another vulnerability in another place. So having a comprehensive background check system with some teeth in it, I think would also make a difference, so that if someone who privately owned assault weapons couldn't just set up shop and sell them, put up ads on internets or go to gun shows and sell them with no background checks or record-keeping process. So I think it's difficult to think of some of these things in isolation, because really the policies, if the intent, of course, is to maximize public safety while minimizing any restrictions on rights, you want to have a comprehensive system that, of course, would have appropriate background checks involved.
Well, Professor Daniel Webster, you're a public health expert, not a political analyst, but here's a key question. Do you see any signs that the body politic is moving any closer to policies that would benefit safety and benefit the public health in the way that you're describing?
Well, all the polls clearly indicate that the public is very ready for such change. The more difficult question is, will their elected officials listen to them, or will they listen to special interest lobby groups? We are at a change point, and really time will tell in these upcoming elections what change ultimately emerges from it.
Professor Daniel Webster, director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in Baltimore. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.